So, our second talk will be by Oliver Tennert from Transtech, and he will talk about parallel NFS. Enjoy.
Good morning, everybody. Now, you're hearing me? Okay. The previous speaker was speaking about HPC computing, about demands there. Parallel NFS is targeted actually to fulfill the demands that are required by high-performance computing. Now, as myself, I'm working with Transtech, which is a manufacturer of complex IT solutions, complex hardware solutions, storage systems, and we also have got many years of experience in high-performance computing, delivering HPC clusters and so on. My talk will be as follows. I would like to give a short motivation why parallel NFS, why is it being invented? Actually, it's currently in the course of being invented right now. It's a standard which is not which has not been finished yet. It's in a draft state, and it's planned to be to become an internet standard. So, we'll give a few words about why standardization is necessary actually in this field. I like to give some details of how it works, and at the end I will give some preliminary benchmark numbers. If you have any questions, please ask me at any time. Just interrupt me. I may or may not be able to answer them because I'm not really a kernel developer of some kind, but we'll see then. So let me first start with some, well, interesting picture. This happened in June of 1908. A massive explosion happened in central Siberia, where several square miles, hundreds of square miles, were devastated. 60 to 80 million trees were felled within seconds. And an earthquake was detected. The Richter scale has not been invented at that time, but later on it was estimated that it was the equivalent of a 5.0 earthquake. The most probable explanation of that is a massive meteorite crashed, which approached Earth with about 40,000 miles per hour, exploding at an altitude of about 10 kilometers and possessing the energy equivalent of 10 to 15 megatons of TNT. So the usual unit of energy when it comes to talking about atomic bombs. Well, how do we know such numbers? Because there were very many eyewitnesses at that time. So these numbers are estimations. How are they got? There are some institutes in America, a governmental institute, Sandia, which is specializing in simulating the effects of atomic bomb detonation, actually. And now, as you can see, from the effect of an atomic bomb detonates or a meteor crashes, the effects are virtually the same. And the task of simulating such a blast is also actually the same. So Sandia is able to simulate atomic bomb detonations as well as simulating meteorite crashes. What you can see here is the real simulation done by them. This is an area of 40 kilometers across, and the altitude is 20 kilometers across. You see the meteorite approaching, and you can see the blast wave going back from the center toward in a circular fashion. It's just a section, of course. And this blast wave, you can see going away to the left and to the right, is what made all the millions of trees just fall down like sticks. So what's that all got to do with the parallel NFS, actually? When it comes to high-performance computing, there are several requirements when you simulate such events. Now, the simulation runs about 10 to 20 seconds. The time to calculate a simulation like that takes hours, up to days, and sometimes weeks. So an HPC simulation like this has a massive need for computing power, which modern CPUs can fulfill. That's actually no problem. Then they have a need for network performance when it comes to parallel processing and parallel simulations, parallel programming. You need a low latency network interconnect like InfiniBand. You can also use gigabit Ethernet, depends on the scaling behavior of your application. So this actually is not a performance bottleneck at the moment right now. What still is a bottleneck is the storage, where huge amounts of data have to be copied to and fro from the CPU to the storage system, from storage system of one cluster node to the storage system of the other cluster node. This is still, this actually is the most important bottleneck right now when it comes to HPC clustering. What you can see out there are several answers to address this issue. But the most deployed solution, actually, which is not really a solution anymore, but more or less the problem per se, but what you can see out there with about 90%, I'd say, of all HPC clusters right now is actually yesterday's solution. You have an NFS server, which is hosting all the data, and you have the cluster nodes on the left, which copy to and fro the NFS server. And as you can see, this is not a scalable solution, actually. The NFS head of the NAS filer is the bottleneck, as well as the storage system attached to that NFS server. So what can you do about it? You can replace the network interconnect of the NFS server with an even faster one. Take 10 gigabit Ethernet also. So you will gain some performance, but of course, it will be a bottleneck by tomorrow then. It's not a scalable solution either. There are also very expensive controllers addressing just or targeted for this solution. Very expensive controller systems, which are just made for delivering a very fast channel from cluster nodes to storage system, but nevertheless, it's only one channel. So it's an inbound solution which is not scalable. It may be fast, but it's limited. You could try to cluster NFS, but clustering NFS is also a very cumbersome problem. Either you can manually partition your global namespace into several subspaces and distribute your file system on some too many NAS filers, but this is cumbersome. It's not automatic and doesn't scale either. You could run 2, 3, 4 NFS servers and synchronize them, but synchronization of them limits scalability too. So the other point is you can't really dynamically load balance NFS because of the inherent state. As you might know, NFS per se, NFS 2, NFS 3, is designed to be a stateless protocol. It's designed to be, in reality it isn't, because it's always an inherent state which has to be taken over from one node to the other. It may be some locks, it may be the reply cache of an NFS server, which is just the cached answers. The NFS server had been given to NFS clients within some period ago. So, actually there is a solution at hand already. The solution is take a distributed file system. A distributed file system like, for example, Lustre. The major features are you have a global namespace. The file system itself delivers you a global namespace. You don't have to partition your namespace and to distribute some subsets of it onto several NFS filers. It's a scalable solution. It can be load balanced. And just to differentiate the two terms, a cluster file system and a parallel file system. When I speak of a parallel file system or a distributed file system, you have no shared storage, actually. You don't have a SAN where many clients access the same storage devices concurrently, which is this the thing, let's say, with GFS2 or OCFS2. Those cluster file systems address a totally different issue. They address the issue of high availability, of accessing the same storage devices, and at the same time, from many paths, in order to realize, for example, an automatic failover, if one server falls down, the other can take over, and so on, and you're able to access the same storage. those cluster file systems do not address the issue of HPC computing, where you have a many-to-many path, actually. You have many clients accessing many storage devices, which you can see now in a couple of minutes. So, and there are already some proprietary solutions out there. There is GPFS by IBM, for example. There is CXFS from SGI. There's also Panassus Active Scale File System, which, as you will see shortly, play a very active role in formulating the parallel NFS standard. There's also EMC, there's Lustre, there's PBFS2, which is an open source Linux distributed file system. But they're proprietary in the sense that there is no open standard which they comply with. It's a proprietary solution, and then you surely can't expect an HPC cluster with IBM's GPFS to cooperate smoothly with a Panassus collection of blade shelves, for example. So there is a standard out there when it comes to file system, it's NFS. NFS actually is the only standard there is. Standard in the sense of an open internet standard. Maybe, I don't know, I'm not an expert, maybe at some time it may be the case with SMB, I don't know. But at the moment, NFS is a standard. Standards are good because they ensure at least a certain kind of interoperability between the products of different manufacturers. They provide choice for the customer, they hold the prices down because of the competition situation, certain commonality leads to less training, some deployment, and so on, and so on. So standards are good. Surely you don't really have to convince people about that. And let me just give you a brief history of NFS so we'll understand why parallel NFS is designed the way it is. NFS was originally designed by Sun in the 80s. NFS 3 is now the most deployed version of it. It's, as I told, stateless by design, but stateful in reality. And actually, NFS 3 is not a single standard by itself, but it's only usable when combined with several else protocols, which are not really part of the NFS 3 standard. When it comes to locking, you need the network lock manager, you need the network state manager, you need the mount protocol, actually to mount the file system in the first hand. So we've got four protocols actually to implement one, or to address one problem, or to realize one solution, four protocols. You have a dynamical port allocation with the help of the port mapper, which makes NFS 3 very unfriendly when it comes to tunneling through firewalls. Okay, you have what you have actually NFS means that access control is not enforced by the server as it should be in a real storage solution, but is enforced with the client. So an NFS client per se must be trusted in your whole system. If it isn't, an NFS client can access everything he wants. So with all these deficiencies, NFS 3 has over the time been extended quietly by vendors like Sun, like IBM. Every vendor has implemented its own ACL protocol for implementing access control lists. There is web NFS, first designed by Sun, which means you can access an NFS share with your browser over the internet. Just type in NFS:// and so on. You've got secure RPCs, which means you can actually combine NFS with Kerberos. But all these extensions have not been standardized with NFS 3. It took some development yet to include all this stuff into NFS 4. Now the version NFS 4 is the most current finalized standard out there for NFS. The development was driven by big names like Sun, NetApp, Hummingbird. Hummingbird is delivering a Windows NFS server, NFS 4 server and client, Maestro Enterprise, as it is. NFS 4 has a lots of new stuff. It's got strong security flavors like the ability to authenticate clients via GSS API. You've got protocol consolidation, which makes NFS4 very firewall friendly. You've got only one fixed protocol in use. It's 2049. You've got no NLM anymore, no SNM, NSM, no mount protocol. As the previous speaker mentioned, you've got a delegation. Delegation is more or less the same as a SysOp block. That means a client is given the exclusive the right for exclusive use of a file. And if another client wants to access the file, the client is asked to give the delegation back. You've got ACLs, which semantically are very similar to Windows ACLs. You've got string-based identities. You haven't got any UIDs, numerical UIDs anymore, but you've got strings, which are transferred over the wire when it comes to authentication and authorization. And NFS4 has just fixed what NFS has ever been. It's written now that NFS4 is a stateful protocol, with the state being managed with leases. And also, NFS4 has got a compound procedure, which has been invented to address the problem of latency. Previously, it was with NFS3, it was the case when you access a file, for example, you had to look up the file and had to look up every subpath of your file, which means looking up a path part, the server gives a reply, gives a new file handler. Now, comes the next lookup for the next component, the server gives a new file handler, and so on, and so on. Now, the file has been found, the file must be opened, and so on. For accessing a single file, there are many messages being exchanged between the NFS client and the NFS server, which is not ideal when it comes to a high latency environment where you've got to transfer all your signals over a very high latency and small bandwidth line, like, for example, well, NFS or something, the internet or something. So the compound procedure is just a container where you can put several RPC operations at once, take all the package and give it to the NFS server, and the NFS server gives also a compound answer back, more or less. So we've got very few exchanges. NFS4.1, as I said, actually in the currently in development, it will be the future internet standard for NFS. It's got sessions, which means a session is a state between a client and a server, which when the client crashes can be reconnected after the crash, so the session is still there even when the client crashes. Got directory delegations, and you also got now parallel NFS as an optional feature. Optional feature means that any NFS server implementation need not implement parallel NFS, but it can. And the standardization is expected at some time, 2009 actually, it was expected this year, but it's not yet finished. Now the generic architecture is like the following. You've got many NFS clients, and you've got one so-called metadata server. The metadata server is actually is the NFS server. This is the NFS server which speaks the NFS4.1 protocol. And the only real communication part that is being defined by the standard is the communication between the NFS clients and the metadata server. This is NFS4.1. Everything else is not defined. There are some conditions which are formulated, like how does the metadata server communicate with the storage devices, but it's not really defined. It's just there are some requirements given. Now, the metadata server is hosting everything that is metadata of the file system itself and of the files. It's hosting information about all the inode data of a file. It's hosting information about how a file is being striped, about the so-called storage devices. As I said, parallel NFS is a many-to-many communication. That is, you have got many NFS clients communicating with many storage devices, and this is a scalable solution because if you increase the number of storage devices, the number of striping possibilities goes up. So you can strive even more, the more storage devices you add. As I said, the actual NFS protocol is being spoken by the NFS clients and the metadata server. The communication spoken by the NFS clients and the storage device is called the storage access protocol. The storage access protocol is totally unspecified. It may be, there may be some new inventions given by manufacturers. This is designed so that manufacturers can implement the new solutions, but still ensure interoperability with non-compliant clients, because if a client is not able to speak the storage access protocol, for example, a metadata server is the standard says the metadata server must be able to give all the data and all the information the client needs from the storage devices themselves. That is, in this case, when the parallel NFS client is not able to speak the storage access protocol, it's still speaking NFS 4.1 with the metadata, so the metadata server is forced to deliver all the data. So this design is an out of band realization of a global namespace, and if the metadata server is needed to deliver the data, the metadata server is then in the path again. So, as I said, the metadata server is hosting all the information about how a file is striped across storage devices, and this information, this very important information, is called a layout. Later on, I will give some details about what different layouts are already out there. Let's just have a look at some new RPC operations defined by the standard. One of the most important operation, actually. Now, get device list and get device info. The client has to know when it mounts a file system, the client must be given the information about what storage devices are out there. With get device list, the server gives the client that information. Actually, the get device list is a question asked by the client to the server. The server gives the information as an answer. In the form of a device ID. Device ID is just a number several bytes long. It doesn't yet tell the clients the addresses of the storage devices. The address may be an IP address when it comes to an iSCSI, a SAN volume, for example. It might be an IP address for an NFS mount, it may be something. With get device info, the client gets just that information, that is the mapping between the device IDs of some numbers and the actual way to access this storage device. With layout get, a client gets the information, all the striping information about a file, and this is the most important information, because if it has the layout, he can't access the files, but if he has the layout, this is the with giving a client a layout, he's implicitly giving the right to access the file. Not only the information, but also the right. Now, when it comes to some I/O, the client may modify the file in access. It may write to the file. It may change the layout in some way, and it has to give the server back the information. And it's doing that with layout commit. So, if the client has finished its I/O and doesn't need the layout anymore, he tells the client by giving the layout commit command. And it may also be the case that the client thinks, I have been given the layout, but I don't need it because I've changed my mind, I don't need to access the file anymore. So it just returns the layout without, there's no committing necessary because no change has actually been taking place. Now with NFS 4, some additional feature has been introduced, that is a callback. Normally, communication between an NFS client and NFS server was also triggered by always triggered by the client. The client gave an RPC procedure, a request, and the server gave an answer. Now with NFS 4, RPC callbacks were introduced. A callback is actually an RPC communication started by the server to the client. The server gives the client some information or request. Like, for example, the layout recall callback, which tells the client to stop using a layout, for example, because it may be the case that a storage device goes down, for example. And such things have, the MDS notices such things have been handled by the metadata server in order to ensure data consistency. So if a layout recall is being given by the server to the clients must answer with a layout commit or layout return procedure. For example, the third one, callback recallable object available, it may be the case that a client opens a file and is given the answer that the file is currently unavailable because it's in access by some other client which has a delegation. Now, in this case, the server asks the client to come back later and gives a callback to the other client to return the layout and withdraws the delegation. So the other client has been given some time, some seconds, milliseconds, and so on, is returning the layout or committing the layout, and now the other client, which is waiting in the queue, can be given the information, now try again, the file can now be accessed. So let's have a short animation how it works. Actually, mounting a file system via the MDS is done like this. MDS is the host data of the file system of the MDS file server. If you use a mount command like this, the first thing that that is done is a putrootfh operation. Putrootfh tells the server to give the client the root file handle for the file system. With that file system, the client can later do some lookups for a file. Now, the second thing is the client needs to know what storage devices are out there. It needs a list of the devices, which it is given by the server. And it needs to know how to address these devices. Now, with get devices, as I said before, the client is given just a list of numbers. And with get device info, the client is given also the mapping of the numbers, the device IDs, to the device addresses. And with that information, now, the client can access a file. The client looks up a file with the lookup operation, which is also new in NFS 4, a lookup of a multi-component path. The server returns a file handler and the state IDs. Like, state IDs actually give the information of how the locking state, for example, of the file is. And the client opens the file afterwards. And at last, the client asks the MDS about the layout for the file, which it's been given after that. And now the next thing is the client can do direct I/O to the storage devices, and the metadata server is out of band. And as you can see, this is a scalable solution because the number of stripes is just the number of storage devices you add. At any time, the metadata server can recall the layout because of some problems or some reconfiguration of anything. At any time, the client can return the layout by itself. But if it doesn't and the client has finished its I/O, the client just commits the changes of the layout and returns it, and that's it. Optionally, if the client is not able, as I said before, to speak parallel NFS, the client can always use normal NFS I/O, NFS 4, via the MDS, and the MDS is now inbound, delivering all the data to the NFS client. That's ensuring interoperability. Now, let's have a look at about different layout formats. A layout is not only just some striping information, it's also with some formats, with some interpretation possibilities, the layout is also including some credentials, some ticket, or the right to access a file. A possession of a layout grants access to the storage devices. Now, the standard itself defines only one layout. It's called the file-based layout. There are two other documents where the so-called block-based layout and the object-based layout is respectively is formulated. And there are also some implementations out there which realize a PFS2 layout or a GPFS layout. Now, what's about this layouts? The file layout means the storage access protocol between the NFS clients and the storage devices is also NFS. This is a very simple layout, which is also very simple to implement, because when it comes to accessing a file via parallel NFS, the layout, in addition to the striping information about which part of the file is hosted by which storage devices, also includes the file handle just to use to access this file, the part of the file from the different storage devices. So it may be the case that a file then is being split into four parts. For accessing each of the four parts, you need a file handle. So the client is giving four file handles, and given the information, with that file handle you get to storage device one, with that file handle you get to storage device two, and you get the second part of the file, and so on and so on. Access control is possible via Kerberos, RPCsec, GSS Security Flavor, which is nothing else as plugging in the GSS API. And it may be heavily cached because the layout itself is required not to change in a qualitative way. That is, if the information says the file is spread in something like a RAID 0 across those three storage devices, the striping pattern will not change even if the file is growing, for example. It's an more or less algorithmic. So there's also a different layout format. It's called the block layout, which is heavily influenced by the proprietary solution already out there by EMC. With this layout, the storage access protocol between the PENFS clients and the storage devices is not file-based but block-based, like in a SAN. So the PENFS clients as well as the storage devices are all parts of a SAN, and the communication is just SCSI block command. With block communication, secure authorization is a bit of a problem because there's no real way to map user access control information to block access control information. There's the SCSI standard, the SCSI block command standard doesn't know anything about users. It just knows anything about logical units being part of the SAN. So secure authorization in this environment is only possible with the host granularity. When it comes, for example, for fencing off a client because of some difficulties in the network, the metadata server additionally needs access to the storage management subsystem. It may be the case that a client crashes, for example, and when it comes up again, it may be in an inconsistent state. So the only way to fence off a client in a situation like this is to work with zoning or with loon masking or whatever. But in order to ensure that, the metadata server, which is in control of all the environment out there, must be able to access the storage management interface, which makes actually handling block-based or using a block layout very non-trivial. And also the clients must be trusted again, because as I said before, there is no real mapping between user access control and SCSI access control, which is actually the fundamental NFS problem ever since. For that reason, an additional layout, and actually an additional SCSI protocol has been invented. It's called the object layout, which is in large parts the work of Panassos. And it grew out of an academic project called NASDI. NASDI is Network Attached Secure Disks, not within the field of HPC, but within the fields of storage security. The SCSI object standard defines a new kind of communication between SCSI initiators and targets, where not blocks of data are exchanged, but objects and contents and data within objects. So a client is not asking about give me blocks 1 million up to 2 million from Loon 0 or something, but it says Loon so-and-so, please give me the data of object with object ID some number. And the object IDs can be directly mapped to files. This mapping is done by the metadata server, and the metadata server is giving the mapping information in form of a layout. So the object layout includes, for a file, includes the object ID, object IDs needed to access different parts of the file from the storage devices, and also a cryptographically secured credential called a capability, which includes actually the right to access data. It's comparable to a Kerberos ticket, more or less. So, as well as solving the problem of HPC computing with parallel storage access, it also solves the problem for secure access in the SAN, because the capability can be withdrawn, and so the storage devices, the NFS clients, are not able anymore to access the storage devices or different files. Okay. This is just a model implementation, a generic implementation, which is more or less the case with Linux when everything's finished. If a manufacturer is having a new idea about a new performing storage access protocol, all it needs to deliver to clients is a new layout driver, which is just a small part down there, and it just defines it's just a bridge between two layers in the storage model, actually. It doesn't have to include a full-fledged driver stack or something. It's just a different, just a simple part of kernel code which says how to interpret layout information. That's it. That's a layout driver. It's just about interpreting the layout, the otherwise opaque layout, actually. So there's a reference implementation for PNFS. It's based on PFS2. Actually, PFS2, as I said before, is a Linux solution out there already. It uses it's also a distributed file system for high performance computing. The difference between PNFS and PFS2 is PFS2 is using an algorithmic striping pattern or layout of the file. So it's actually not a dynamical thing like when accessing a file, the client needs a layout information because it's part of a static configuration. It's also got no locking subsystem, no data caching, and so on. So it's a solution already present out there, and the reference implementation for PNFS for Linux is just having the PNFS server being just a VFS2 client, so playing the part of a proxy or bridge between a PNFS world and the PVFS world. The PNFS clients are talking to the PNFS server. The PNFS server is VFS2 client and is getting the interpretation of the algorithmic PVFS2 layout configuration and translating it into a PNFS2 layout format. Now, let me just give you the current state of PNFS. PNFS for Linux, there's already a file layout out there. It's based on PVFS2, and there's also another file layout based on NFS4. I'm not quite sure. I think it's done by NetApp. For OpenSolaris, there's a file-based and an object-based layout already done by Sun themselves. NetApp is working on a file layout for their own filers and also for Linux, I think. IBM is also working on a file layout based on GPFS2. EMC is delivering a block layout, and Panacess is delivering an object layout, always for their own products, of course. So Panacess, it's already a proprietary solution out there working with PANFS distributed file system. And what they do right now is just tweaking the protocol, their storage access protocol a bit in order to be PNFS compliant. Actually, if you look at the PANFS solution and the PNFS solution, you'll see there are very many similarities. And the Carnegie Mellon University which hosts some academic groups, is doing some performance and correctness testing of all the codes, is being part of the standard committee and so on. Okay, I apologize for that because those are not my benchmarks. I have not been able to set up an environment just in time. It's being stolen from the University of Michigan homepage where the City Project is hosted. The setup is you've got 16 storage devices and you've got some 23 clients, all have the same architecture. And in the above figure you can see the x-axis is giving the number of processes, which is actually the number of clients talking at the same time to the storage devices or to the global file system. And as you can see, the scaling, well, it's there, but it's not perfect, but it's a scaling when it goes up to 16 processes because you've got 16 storage nodes. You might be able to have a scaling up to 16 clients. They're all connected with gigabit Ethernet. So it's not a perfect scaling, but after that, there's no scaling at all. Now the aggregated bandwidth is saturated, and you have got no scaling anymore. The bandwidth is every client has this is 100 megabytes per second, 200, 300, 400 megabytes per second. When showing such figures, it's always important to know it's the aggregate bandwidth, the aggregated bandwidth of all clients accessing the storage device at the same time. It's not a bandwidth for one client or so, it's the aggregate bandwidth. This is for writing, this is for reading. Looks very perfect to me. Not quite sure if it's, well, as I said, I apologize for that. Those are not my numbers, those are given by the City Project. But even if they're tuned a bit, it looks very scalable. And some web links for more information. Questions, please. Okay? There's no replication being done. It's striping.
So if one storage device fails, that information is lost.
It's depending on the actual implementation. There may be some implementations which make use of a RAID 5 or so. Maybe, yes. But that's not part of the standard, actually. Okay. That's implementation detail. It's left to the manufacturers to implement their own solutions. It's not defined by the standard. You may have, but you may have not. It's not defined by the standard. It's given by the manufacturers. The standard does not define different layouts. It just defines one possible layout. There may be different layouts out there.
So but what's the practical solution?
The practical solution is use some better implementations already done and test it. It's not yet finished. It's not finished work. You see, it's vision, it's future.
I'm sorry to say that, but we're running out of time. Thank you very much. We will now have a short break. You have the opportunity to chat during the break, get some refreshment, and please be back at 11:15 for the next talk.